Welcome to The Lid Is On, our podcast series here at the United Nations. I'm Matthew Wells. Well, today I've swapped the office on the 11th floor for the beach on the eastern edge of New York City and what lies beyond. The ocean, Earth's life support system, the place where life itself likely began, needs our help.
Here's how it's going to be if we keep doing what we're doing. 90% of the big fish gone. How long before they'll all be gone? How long before the last tuna will bring a high price? How long before the last cod will swim in the North Sea? How long before we see a disappearance of all of the coral reefs, knowing that we've lost half in less than half a century?
That's Sylvia Earle talking to me at UN headquarters as we looked out a short while ago on New York's own East River, which feeds into the mighty Atlantic Ocean just a few miles downstream. Known as her deepness to some, a living legend or hero for the planet to others, she knows the ocean better than most, having led more than 100 expeditions and logged more than 7,000 hours underwater. She's the former chief scientist of the United States National Oceanic Service, NOAA, founder of Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, and her own alliance to protect the ocean, Mission Blue. She's devoted her whole life to understanding the ocean, and she didn't visit us here just to admire the view. I'll let her explain.
On the 8th of June, 2017, here at the United Nations, where we're having this conversation, something remarkable is happening. The United Nations is getting behind the idea of celebrating the ocean, examining the issues. What are the problems that we now face, and what can be done as individual nations, as nations working together?
The Ocean Conference aims to address and reverse the deterioration of the ocean, getting humanity to change course and use the unique benefits of the ocean more sustainably. At a recent press conference, the President of the UN General Assembly, Peter Thompson, who's from a Pacific Island state that's facing an existential crisis over the overheating ocean, explained it this way.
I see it as the opportunity for us to address these major problems, these major woes that humanity has put upon the ocean. Rising ocean temperatures, serious business for the tropics. Life is leaving our tropical waters, it's too hot. 40% of the cause of rising sea levels comes from the fact that ocean temperatures are heating and, of course, expanding. So I could go on and on about the woes of the ocean, but all human problems have got human solutions, and that's what the Ocean Conference is about.
Sylvia Earle's looking forward to being there, to stand up for her own beloved ocean and repeat the warning she made more than 2 years ago here at the UN, that the living ocean is not too big to fail. But it's not too late to act either, she says.
There's plenty of reason for hope. People do care. We are seeing a trend. We are seeing revision of fishing policies to favor the fish, to favor the blue carbon value of fish. The fish, like trees, help capture, hold, sequester carbon. All living things are carbon-based units. And the ocean is the biggest reservoir of carbon. The deep sea, the greatest place where carbon is already being sequestered. What we want to do is maintain that so that Earth continues.
So Sylvia Earle, here we are. We're at UN headquarters, overlooking New York's East River, which in turn flows down into New York Harbor and, of course, then into the Atlantic Ocean itself. Can you just tell people, first of all, why you first fell in love with the ocean, how you fell in love with the ocean, and what the circumstances were?
It was pretty easy. I got knocked over by a wave on the New Jersey shore when I was 3 years old, and the ocean got my attention. And when my parents moved to Florida when I was 12, my backyard was the ocean, the Gulf of Mexico. So it was pretty natural. Some kids have, you know, a neighborhood that has trees and streets and playgrounds and things. My backyard was wet. And I don't know, I, as a kid, knew that I wanted to be a scientist. I didn't not know what to call it, but it had to do something with plants and animals. And I came to understand that most of life on Earth is actually in the ocean. So I have been drawn to the sea partly out of curiosity that started as a kid and continues right up to the present time.
I mean, I first fell in love with the sea watching, I'm sure like millions of others around the world, the Jacques Cousteau TV shows. I mean, and then that in turn led me to want to learn how to scuba dive in my 20s. And can you just convey to people who haven't been under the sea or in the sea wearing scuba apparatus what that feeling's like and just how different it is?
Even before Jacques Cousteau's book, Silent World, and the television programs that followed, I read a book by William Beebe, who, with an engineer colleague, Otis Barton, in the 1930s, he was diving as much as half a mile beneath the surface, 1,000 meters, and described the flash, sparkle, and glow of bioluminescent creatures that he said looked like suns, moons, and stars in the velvet darkness of the deep sea, because light penetrates about 1,000 feet, in some places a little deeper, but in places like San Francisco Bay and New York Harbor, not so much at all.
But it really is another world, isn't it? It's like, you know, and it seems to be, to me anyway, a much more complex world than the world of atmosphere.
Thing is, what's underwater is most of what Earth is all about. This is a living planet because there is an ocean. And the ocean is not just rocks and water. The ocean is like a living soup, minestrone, but with all the little pieces, living things. And some of them are really big, like whales and tunas and turtles and things. But most of the action is really very small. The phytoplankton that generates really most of the oxygen that we breathe, as well as the oxygen that penetrates the ocean and fosters life in the salty part of the planet, takes up carbon dioxide and drives the carbon cycle, just as trees and other photosynthetic organisms on the land. Seaweeds and mostly the small phytoplankton in the sea, really, it's vital to all life on Earth.
The tiniest of life and the very largest in terms of the blue whale.
Well, the spectrum of life in the sea is far more diverse than what we are more familiar with on the land. The big groups of animals, you know, the jellies and corals constituting one big category of life, the greatest diversity, essentially all of these major divisions of life are in the ocean. Only about half occur, even in the richest rainforests and other areas of high diversity on the land. You know, you think maybe 15 phyla of animals, and then there are, of course, the microbes and the photosynthetic organisms as well. But the greatest action, the greatest diversity, the greatest abundance, the greatest mass of Earth's life is where the water is. It's the ocean. That's where 97% of Earth's water is located.
So when did you first realize, as a scientist, as an explorer of the ocean, that things were going badly wrong?
Well, when I was a kid, the ocean already showed signs of impact on the coast of Florida. The transformation of the coastline, some of the places that I first knew, the seagrass meadows and the mangroves, disappeared because they were filled and became transformed into housing developments and parking lots, and the shoreline that was once softened by vegetation became walled off with seawalls that are not really as effective as a barrier in protecting the land as the living systems are, but we didn't know. In fact, that's the greatest changes, I think, aside from what's happened to the ocean, is changes of attitude. People now know what they could not know going back to the middle of the 20th century. Now we're armed with insight, knowledge.
We've got the data.
Oh, yeah, evidence that our actions are altering the nature of all of nature, but you can certainly see it in the ocean.
And are you convinced this really is 100% man-made, this crisis that's going on in the oceans and the world's climate overall?
Well, there have been changes through geologic time. Comets strike the Earth, boom, and things change. The magnetic poles shift with some effect on the nature of things. Whatever. We've seen through looking at the geologic record that ice ages come, ice ages go. There's constant change, but what's different is our impact on the nature of nature. We have power that transcends that of any other species in all, as far as we can tell, of all of the history of the planet. And it's happening on our watch in decades, not over millennia. We are the agents of change, but we're also agents unlike any other creatures. We have the gift of learning, of knowledge, over generations. So now we know basically that we are changing climate. We are changing the nature of the skies above. We are changing the nature of the ocean, the composition of the diversity of life that we share space with on this little blue miracle Earth in all of the universe of unfriendly options.
I watched a talk you gave several years ago, and the kind of shocking statistic that you uttered that got my attention most was that 90% of all big fish have gone, and that more than 50% of the world's coral. I mean, and that was several years ago. Are things getting inexorably worse at the moment?
Oh, they are. Yet, I also see we're right at the point as understanding of why the ocean matters comes into focus. People are motivated because they're beginning to understand that everything we care about depends on taking care of the natural systems that take care of us. And if you like to breathe, listen up. If you like the fact that water magically falls out of the sky, we need to be concerned. It's taking care of the fundamentals, our life support system, that until the 20th century, I think it was fair to say that people did take our life support system for granted. We could breathe, so people always breathed, and no problems. But we could also begin to see the impact of pollution on the atmosphere above. That's still an issue that is driving policy changes. As we become aware of our ability to impact something as basic as breathing, or even looking at the decline of phytoplankton in the sea, perhaps as much as 40%, according to some of the measures that have been taken based on evidence. We're not making this up. We're looking at the records of what scientists, observers who have accumulated data, no self-interest involved except living, surviving, getting the numbers, making samples. We have evidence that polar ice is disappearing faster than at any time in human history. Why? Well, there's a direct correlation. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, methane, the greenhouse gases that are originated from our actions, warming the planet, causing the melting, sea level rise, excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere becoming carbonic acid, ocean becoming acidic. Changing the chemistry of the planet changes everything, whether we're talking the atmosphere above or the ocean globally, freshwater as well as the ocean. All things considered, all this apparently bad news is actually cause for hope. What would really be a problem is if we did not know.
Do you find that people in general sort of neglect or don't think about the oceans enough? I mean, obviously, there's a geographic issue, isn't there? If you are someone from the American Midwest or you come from the plain or the jungle of Central Africa, you don't get to see it. You don't get to really have that visceral connection. How big a problem is that?
It would be perceived as a greater problem before this time in history. Now, there's really no excuse for people not being aware that the world is round-ish. Not quite round, but, you know, we have the view of space. Kids grow up armed with knowledge. Now we know that the ocean drives climate, drives weather, holds the planet steady in terms of regulation of temperature, absorbs and distributes heat and cold. I mean, the ocean is where the action is. It's where, as I say, most of life on Earth is in the ocean. Now we know. And granted, there's some places on the planet that do not have access to the forms of communication that are available in some other parts of the planet. The internet is not everywhere, but consider that it didn't exist when I was a kid, but I became aware by looking at books, by arming myself with the knowledge that my predecessors had gathered so that I could see with my own eyes when changes were taking place that were not in my best interest, when the bay that I loved in Clearwater, Florida, no longer was clear.
So what's the most important thing that a sort of maybe somewhat climate skeptical Midwesterner needs to know about just how valuable these oceans are and how, if we just allow it to continue, it's going to have catastrophic effects?
Those who are skeptical about the human drivers behind climate change get an automatic membership in the Flat Earth Society. They just are ignoring the evidence. I'm a scientist. I live by the evidence, both by what I see myself and look at trusted sources. There are plenty of sources out there that I consider not trustworthy. I just make things up, and marketing sometimes is not based on facts, not based on evidence, not based on the truth. Scientists do their utmost to find what we revere as the reality, the truth. But of course, most parents want a better life for their children. It was certainly a driver for my parents, and I just love seeing opportunities for my kids and my grandchildren to maintain a planet that really works in our favor. And I'm literally terrified of some of the actions that continue despite the evidence.
The UN's convening this very major conference on oceans in June. How big a deal do you think this is? I mean, what's the way to make sure that it has the most impact, do you think? I mean, here we are sitting at UN headquarters.
Right. On the 8th of June, 2017, here at the United Nations, where we're having this conversation, something remarkable is happening. The United Nations is getting behind the idea of celebrating the ocean, examining the issues. What are the problems that we now face, and what can be done as individual nations, as nations working together? You know, it's only through the United Nations that half of the world, the high seas, can really be addressed with some authority. We thought the ocean was too big to fail going back not so many years ago, and there are people today who still have this illusion that somehow...
It's infinite.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter what we put in the ocean, that's the big dump site, that the ocean will continue to be the great reservoir, whatever we don't want close to where we live, and that the ocean is an infinite source of whatever we want to take out. But now we have plenty of evidence to the contrary. There's an analysis possible now with computers that can crunch the numbers. Individuals alone cannot grasp or see. They can show us that here are the trends. Here's the way it was. Here's the way it is. Here's how it's going to be if we keep doing what we're doing. 90% of the big fish gone in a matter of decades. Where is it going? How long before they'll all be gone? How long before the last tuna will bring a high price? How long before the last cod will swim in the North Sea? How long before we see a disappearance of all of the coral reefs, knowing that we've lost half in less than half a century?
You encourage that the sustainability of life below the sea is enshrined in one of these 17 Sustainable Development Goals, number 14. Is that something that you think people will rise to the challenge of, or do you think it's a little too abstract perhaps to be talking these terms?
The Sustainable Development Goals are a good starting place, but we need to be aware, as new evidence is gathered, of how we must continue to respond to the reality. For example, the idea that we can take large quantities of ocean wildlife as a source of sustenance must be evaluated constantly, because although some people, particularly in coastal communities and island nations, really do rely on the ocean for sustenance, wildlife taken from the sea, not cultivated like we grow most of the calories that people consume, but actually taken from the wild. And I ask sometimes, how many wild birds do we now take as a source of sustenance or even choice? We take a few.
So we're being way too careless still with the ocean, this idea that it's somehow we can turn it into the next great food supply source, etc.
Well, we need to look at ocean life for what it really is, wildlife. We have not planted the fish. We don't pay taxes on the ocean that we take fish from. We're heavily subsidizing large-scale industrial fishing. And there's plenty of evidence based on the decline over a few decades of these large fish and small fish, too. And even things like oysters, from where they were early in the 20th century to where they are today in places like New York Harbor, where we're looking right now, used to be have a huge impact on the quality of water, and people mined the oysters from the ocean the way we're mining fish, clear-cutting fish from the ocean today, using techniques that take much faster than, in the case of oysters, than they could replenish themselves. And now that we're taking fish from the ocean faster than they can replenish themselves, and other factors such as pollution and warming that do not favor continued level of production. So I say we just have to keep evaluating our expectations of what the ocean can continue to deliver, and also what we need to do to protect the ocean. So presently, kind of an optimistic level of how much of the ocean is deliberately protected, it's about 4%. The good news is that number is climbing from where it was 10 years ago when it was about 0.1%. If we keep on, maybe the United Nations goal of 10% by 2020 can realistically be achieved. Important as that goal is, 10% of the ocean, when we rely on 100% of the ocean for our existence, it's the blue heart of the planet. How much of your heart do you want to protect? Now, we will use the ocean we will use the ocean to extract wildlife for sustenance and also for
millions,
sharks.
Of course, depend on it for their livelihoods and for their existence, don't they?
Well, but for food.
Subsistence fishermen. Like.
Yes, but for most of what's taken, it's not for food that is required. It's food that is a choice. Few people who eat tuna really need to eat tuna. Few people who eat oysters really need to eat oysters, but in fact, it's a choice. Maybe we need to consider choosing to give life, wildlife in the ocean, a break to recover so that we can...
A moratorium?
Or just scale back, for heaven's sakes. Or consider the subsidies, or consider that much of the industrial fishing is undercutting the subsistence fishing. Industrial-scale extraction of wildlife does not typically serve local people. It typically is serving a global market, a luxury choice. It's nice to have a choice, eat lobster and eat tuna and all that, but maybe we need to rethink the value of ocean wildlife. We can see clearly what dead fish are worth, but what are live fish worth? How important are coral reefs? It's not just the buildings in New York that matter, it's the life of New York. It's the taxi drivers, it's Wall Street, it's people who live in the city, like the fish and other creatures that populate a coral reef, including the living corals themselves. That's what we need to look at. So stripping the fish out of a coral reef means that you're really taking the life, literally, out of the coral reef.
What would you most like to see emerge from this UN conference in June? What are the top things that you're looking for humanity to coalesce around, if you like?
Well, first of all, to recognize the importance of the ocean, the living ocean, not to really focus so much on what we extract from the ocean in terms of goods, whether it's mining, minerals, oil, gas, fish, but to really understand that what matters most is the living ocean, that the most important thing that we extract from the ocean is our existence. Earth is hospitable for us, not just because of the water and the substance of the ocean, but because it's alive. We have had a mindset collectively that the ocean is important because of the commodities that we extract. It was whales at one time. It's the oysters in New York Harbor and Chesapeake Bay and around the world. The ocean is a means of transportation. It's the ocean as a place to play, the recreational. All those things taken together are just a fraction of why the ocean matters. The ocean matters mostly because we're here. We live. The ocean makes Earth the living planet that is our home. It's in trouble. And at the Ocean Conference at the United Nations, June 8th, and around the world, celebrating World Ocean Day, we should be saluting the ocean and thinking what collectively and individually, as countries, as the combined United Nations, what can we do to take care of the ocean that is always taking care of us?
Many people wondering may be thinking, goodness, is it just too late? Is it too late to reverse the damage that's been done?
It's not too late to make things better than they otherwise would be if we do nothing. We can see the trend. If we continue down the track, half the coral reef's gone in half a century, how long before they'll all be gone? 90% of many of the fish in the sea, and sometimes it's only 80% or 50% or 20%, but the trend is not good from where we were 50 years ago to where we are today. How long will it take if we just keep going as we're going? By the end of this century, many things will have become irreversible. Some things may already be there, but there's plenty of reason for hope because people do care. We are seeing a trend. We are seeing revision of fishing policies to favor the fish, to favor the blue carbon value of fish. The fish, like trees, help capture, hold, sequester carbon. All living things are carbon-based units. And the ocean is the biggest reservoir of carbon. The deep sea, the greatest place where carbon is already being sequestered. What we want to do is maintain that so that Earth continues to support us. I mean, we can see what the consequences of bad behavior will lead to. We can also see the consequences of what good behavior, good choices will lead to. A world that can be sustained in our favor.
Sylvia Earle, thanks very much indeed. That was Sylvia Earle, now in her early 80s, and a key voice we'll be hearing during the upcoming Ocean Conference, which will run between the 5th and the 9th of June here at UN headquarters. Well, this has been a special interview episode of The Lid Is On, our podcast series at the UN, dedicated this time to the life force that is the ocean. As Sylvia herself told a UN meeting a few years ago, no ocean, no life. No blue, no green. No ocean, no us. I'm Matthew Wells. Thanks for listening.